This is Fair Mormon Frameworks on the Mormon Faircast. The Fair Mormon Frameworks series seeks to present Latter-day Saints whose grasp or knowledge about a specific topic can help us consider different frameworks within the gospel that lead with faith. I am your host, Bill Real.
Today we sit down with Richard Bushman, author of Rough Stone Rolling, a biography of the prophet Joseph Smith. In our conversation today, we talk with Richard about struggling with doubts and the tough issues within the church, and how we, as members of the church, when we encounter someone who's struggling, can be more helpful and receptive to helping them through those doubts to a place where, as Elder Holland said, they can lead with faith. Now on to my interview with Richard Bushman.
Brother Richard Bushman, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Glad to have you on. All my listeners are going to know who you are. So I don't know that an introduction is in place, but I would certainly love for you to maybe just share a few thoughts with us on some background from you, if you don't mind.
Well, I was born in Salt Lake, but I was part of the Mormon diaspora during the Great Depression when my dad had trouble getting enough work in Salt Lake. He was a fashion artist. So we moved to Portland, where he worked for Meyer and Frank, a big department store there that later bought CCMI. And so I just grew up in the church at a time when it was still a very small operation in Oregon. The one stake based in Portland reached 100 to 200 miles in either direction, north, south, and east. So we sort of felt like pioneers. We went to church and little halls and so on. So I was sort of brought up in when the church seemed weak and small rather than strong. And went to high school there, got interested because of an interviewer who came to our high school in Eastern colleges. So I applied to Harvard and was admitted and went to school there. And that's, I guess, when you say I had my faith crisis. My faith crisis had nothing to do with the church as a particular denomination, but with the existence of God, which was a big question mark in undergraduate life in those days. But I came through it, went on a mission to New England, and got a degree in the history of American civilization. First job was at BYU. Stayed there for 6 years, and then was offered a position at Boston University, where moved with our little family. We had four children, five children by then. And so then moved to Delaware and then back to Columbia. So we've sort of been sort of academic gypsies, moving from job to job. But finally, we've settled in New York. All during this time, I was writing early American history. That's how most historians think of me. But also, as lots of Latter-day Saint scholars interested simultaneously in church things. So when Leonard Erickson asked me to write a book about Joseph Smith for his new church history series, I agreed. And that got me back into the business more seriously. So later I expanded that brief early history of Joseph into a full-length biography, which people know as Rough Stone Rolling. So I've kind of lived this double life. A historian of early America, still do early American work, but also as a Latter-day Saint historian.
Wonderful. Glad to hear all of that. And it is, you know, for my listeners, it is, I think, a comfort to them to know that in some way you had a faith crisis as well as a young man. And I guess I want to start off, I want to use as the backdrop of our discussion today a paper that you wrote or a talk you gave in 2008. Which was Joseph Smith and his critics, because I think you described the faith crisis journey or process beautifully. And I want to start off by reading the first paragraph from this. It says, increasingly, teachers and church leaders at all levels are approached by Latter-day Saints who have lost confidence in Joseph Smith, in the basic miraculous events of church history. They doubt the First Vision, the Book of Mormon, many of Joseph's revelations, and much besides. They fall into doubt after going into the internet, finding shocking information about Joseph Smith based on documents and facts they had never heard before. A surprising number had not known about Joseph Smith's plural wives. They are set back by differences in the various accounts of the First Vision. they find that Egyptologists do not translate the Abraham manuscripts the way Joseph Smith did, making it appear that the Book of Abraham was a fabrication. When they come across this information in a critical book or read it on one of the innumerable critical internet sites, they feel as if they've been introduced to a Joseph Smith in church history they had never known before. They undergo an experience like viewing the famous picture of a beautiful woman who in the blink of an eye turns into an old hag. Everything changes. What are they to believe? The reason I start off reading that, you describe my experience perfectly. When I encountered my faith crisis, this is exactly the way I felt. This is the reasons I ran into problems. And so how did you get such a good feel for how many, how can I say it this way? How did you get such a good feel for the way in which a lot of us are struggling with doubts and with a faith crisis?
Well, I was kind of in the middle of that almost from the beginning when the internet became accessible to so many people. Because I had written Rough Stone Rolling, which seemed to bring a number of these issues out into the open, people thought of me as someone to turn to when they got in the middle of this. So I was received innumerable emails, especially from people. And sometimes friends would say, will you please talk to my brother or my cousin or someone. I got a lot of what I said there from a long conversation I had with a couple in Berlin. He was the bishop. She'd been the Relief Society president. But they had just gone through this struggle. And I actually checked that article with this brother, and he gets quoted later on in the piece to make sure I was being authentic. So the stories were so similar. I mean, it was just a pattern that occurred over and over again that it really wasn't too hard in the long run to sort of put this all together and sum it up as I did in that piece.
And that's good. It really is described so well. And I don't want to get into reading every single part of this, but there's a couple parts I want to read because I think you hit the nail right on the head. The next part you go into, which is the reaction that people who enter a faith crisis get from those around them. You say often church leaders, parents, and friends do not understand the force of this alternate view. Not knowing how to respond, they react defensively. They are inclined to dismiss all the evidence as anti-Mormon or of the devil. Stop reading these things if they upset you so much, the inquirer is told. Or go back to the familiar formula of scriptures, prayer, and church attendance. So I want to start off with a question, which is, how can we as a church, or even as individuals, how can we better address how family or leaders react to those in crisis?
Well, it's a matter of a widespread education and experience. I think there are lots of people now who are thinking this through at all levels of the church. They're forced to by the people who come to them. And I think basically the need is to take these people seriously. And they run into a huge blow. You know, it's like learning you have cancer or that your mother died. It's something very real in your life, and it should never be belittled. And the fact is there are lots of real problems. They have to be confronted. So as we sort of educate ourselves or are educated by people who are having troubles, I think we're going to become more sympathetic. There's a very strong pastoral urge in the church, widespread, and people are going to really want to help. And when they begin to see what the picture really is, I think we'll get better and better at doing it.
That's a good point. I know personally that there are some wards and stakes that are wrapping their arms around the idea of helping leadership and members to be more supportive, to be more helpful, to train them to better understand the process of a faith crisis. But I also know of some wards and stakes that won't touch the idea with a 10-foot pole. They're afraid that by even talking about faith crisis, that it's going to bring a faith crisis unto others. And I know in the church, behind the scenes, as we're talking about how to help people struggling with faith, there's this idea of inoculation. And some people fear that by using this information to inoculate members, that in reality will cause more trouble than we help. But where do you come down on that?
Well, it is true that in the process of teaching people about our history, you're going to shock some of them. And I think there are people who read Rough Stone Rolling who were aghast at what they learned, especially about polygamy. But we just don't have a choice. We just have to tell the story. And I don't think it's a matter of saying, we've got these problems and here's how you deal with them. It's a matter more of integrating all the information into a single story. So it just becomes part of what you learn. Everybody learns that there are many versions of the first vision. Everybody learns that the Book of Abraham translation doesn't conform to what's on the text. These things just have to be told. I always say it's like telling your kids about sex. If you're all uptight about it, they're going to be uptight about it. But if you take it as just part of life and they're a little more casual, they will take it the same way and it won't upset them nearly as much.
So there are people in the church who once knew. I remember in my testimonies after I joined the church, I was very prone to get up and say, I know with every fiber of my being that this is true and that is true. And I would see everything as miraculous. And maybe put more behind what God was doing with me or with the people around me than what was actually going on. For those who once knew and now they only believe, a lot of them get flack or feel resistance from members around them, and they're almost seen as less than. And so my question is, what would you say to those who, as they see someone in a faith crisis, their immediate reaction is to see them as is being less than faithful?
Yeah, that's really a tricky question. It's like someone who's been divorced. They're great one day, and then they're divorced, and think, oh, you've got problems. And we just subconsciously begin to treat them differently. I'm hearing more and more talk. Of course, it's in the circles where I live, and it's not in the wider church, that really doubt is part of faith, and that I have a son who has trouble believing, but he lives his life in a good Mormon way, says prayers, serves in the church. And I say he exercises faith. And I find that very admirable, that he just believes there's something good there and he's going to hold on and that things will work out for him as time goes by. So I think it's just a matter of widening the spectrum. And partly it'll be from talks and conference and sort of authoritative statements saying, look, don't give up if you have doubts. It's part of ordinary life. But part of it will just be from experience. It'll be people like you bearing your testimony. And my guess is, I'm just really guessing here now, is that you may have got some negative responses at first, but as it goes along and you prove yourself faithful and willing to do your part in the church, people become adjusted to it. And they say, well, there it is. You may have doubts, but he's a good guy.
In trying to understand how faith develops, the missionaries go out and they teach Moroni chapter 10. And while a lot of people get answers that way, some people get answers Alma 32, which talks about the seed and planting a little seed here and a little seed there and things growing little by little. And then Doctrine and Covenants 46 talks about how it is given unto some to have faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and others to have faith to believe in their words that they might have eternal life also. So we see this process that faith develops in different ways. Yet in the church, we kind of value people who have knowledge over people who hope or believe. And I know Elder Holland in his last conference talk addressed that belief was okay, that there was nothing wrong with believing. But even in that talk, there's this kind of idea that, you know, if you believe right now, that's okay, but at some point, it needs to lead to knowledge. And some members of the church never get there. Do you have any thoughts on those who live their whole lives just believing or just hoping?
Yeah. Well, I love those people, and I think that's actually the state of human life, that we can't be certain about the very most important things in our lives. So, and I think your comparison of Alma 32 versus the definite belief testimony is right on target. I mean, I make it Joseph Smith's first vision versus Alma 32. Joseph Smith says you can question, but then you have a definitive experience that makes it certain, and that's it. You now have it. down to 32 is always always growing. I worry a little bit about putting too much stress on Verona 10 and 4 or the first vision, because it just doesn't work that way. And I've known some very, very good people who struggled growing up in the church to get a powerful confirmation, and it never came. And they say, well, I cannot be a Mormon. It does not work for me. So they drop out. I think that's a bad mistake. So there we have Alma 32 is the way, and Alma 32 never ends in complete knowledge. You know the seed is good, so you keep cultivating it. But you don't know the whole thing is true. There's never complete certainty about everything. It's just a step-by-step knowledge. So I think that needs to be taught over and over again in the church in order to cultivate different kinds of souls who learn the gospel differently.
Yeah, it seems like you're speaking to this idea that as you say, we need to talk about it over and over again, that just one talk here or one talk there isn't going to fix it, that we've got to just constantly stay on this and address it. And in your 2008 address, you gave some suggestions on how we can better deal with this difficult information that people come in contact with. And the first step you list, you say, we begin by agreeing that criticisms of Joseph Smith should not be dismissed as foolish or purely evil. And I find that happens a lot. If ever somebody says, I'm really struggling with this issue that I found on the internet, whatever that issue is, the immediate response they get is, oh, that's anti-Mormon propaganda, or that's a lie. Tell me why that's, can you maybe share with us why that's not helpful?
Well, I think that when people seek for help and receive that, the reaction is not to say, well, I guess you're right, I've got to get out of these troubled waters. It's to say, you don't understand. You refuse to think or face up to the problem. So that's why one of the common accusations against the church, you have to turn off your mind. You cannot be candid. I had a guy in one of my seminars on Mormon culture, very faithful person, and he said he had always worried about studying church history for fear he'd run onto things that he'd have to suppress or couldn't be candid about. So long as you have a feeling that if you really looked at everything, if you turned over every rock, you might be shocked with what you found. You don't have a secure testimony. Until you can look at everything squarely, you really are on shaky ground. So I think we just got to get rid of that idea that some questions are out of bounds, or we will be building on the sand.
Right. We need to value all truth. And if searching through history uncovers some muddy fact that we've got to put in better context, then at least we're still seeking after truth. And obviously, as Elder Holland said, we should lead with faith, which kind of goes into your second piece of advice, which is to avoid dogmatic answers. And I love the sentence you use here. You say, rather than destroy the critics, we want to loosen their grip. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the problems is that you get dogmatism versus dogmatism, that so many of the people who have their faith shaken knew for sure they had certain testimony, and then they lose their testimony, and then they know for sure that the church is false, and they're just as dogmatic after the change as before. And neither one of them is sound or based on a real search for understanding. These things are just immensely complicated, and there's no way that through thinking these through and looking at everything you can arrive at certain conclusions. That's easy for me as a scholar to say, because that's the nature of historical knowledge. Every historian knows that the biggest questions are all unanswerable, or you have very restricted answers to most of the big questions. So I think the better way to say is there is a way of looking at things that's favorable to the church. You don't have to interpret everything in a negative way. So all I aim when I talk to people is to keep the conversation open. Don't close your mind. Don't decide it's now all over. I'm trying to rehabilitate the word investigator, we make the investigators a preliminary stage to full-fledged membership. But investigator is a wonderful description of the religious life. You're always investigating. How can I find God? And it requires sort of an open mind, a questing spirit. And out of that, I think, comes beautiful results if we can tolerate it. So that's my aim, is to keep the conversation going, to keep people looking at the possible meanings of all the things we turn over.
Yeah, I think you hit on a beautiful point as you're talking about that. If rather than we try to bury the critic and their argument, we simply say, hey, there's other possible conclusions, other ways to look at this information, then all of a sudden agency's back on the table. And for those people who want to lead with faith, now they have two conclusions they can go to. And with faith being on the table, with both conclusions being reasonable and perhaps valid, it then puts the choice back in their own hands, which I think more times than not can lead one to stay in the church and to make their way through it and figure it out.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. I think it's faced it very beautifully. I think Carol Givens has stated that case as well as anyone. And for me, that's exactly the goal we should strive for.
Yeah, you mentioned Terrell. I know you and Terrell, and I think Fiona as well, have been going around at least doing one, maybe there's more on the works, but some firesides for people who are struggling with their faith. And one question I want to ask is, there are some people who once believed, they encounter this stuff, they determine the church isn't true, and they leave. And they think that those who stand and continue to say, hey, hang in there, there's room for faith, we believe, tend to think that some of us are faking it. Any thoughts from you on the gospel and how there really is room for faith, and there's more to it than just faking it and going along on something less than?
I will confess, I try to be very tolerant with people, but I'm pretty resentful of that conclusion, that anyone who really believes is faking it. That's very, very presumptuous, they say about someone else, and especially when you're talking about people of character and standing and commitment and very responsible good people. I think it's a kind of a second-grade defense of your own certainty that you say everyone, if they were honest, would see things exactly the way I do. That's the kind of dogmatism that I've been objecting to. So I just think that human life is much more complicated than some of these people think. They think that by reducing everything to reason and knowledge, they can reach simple, sure conclusions. But the history of philosophy, the history of religion, the history of science shows that's not true. Things are always up in the air. Things are always having to be reformulated. So to say that someone couldn't, in good judgment, looking at all the facts, arrive at the conclusion that the gospel is true, that God is leading us, that he's there and answering our prayers, I think that's... As I say, I think that's presumptuous.
Right, and I agree with that. It's very easy, like you say, to think that the rest of the world would respond the same way you do if they had the same information you have. But in reality, even if we give 100 people in the room the exact same information, people will come up with different conclusions. And like you say, it's presumptuous to assume that you've got the right answer and the other 99 people are off base and somehow need to arrive at where you're at.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing I wanted to ask, and this kind of ties into one of the questions I asked earlier, but is there anything that you and me and others in the church who understand the issue of faith crisis, is there anything we can do to stand out as safe people for others to see and recognize so that they know there's someone they can come talk to?
Well, I think just airing the issues, just as you're doing on this blog, is a huge part of it. I was thrilled to walk into a priesthood religious society meeting once where they were talking openly about pornography. How do we deal with pornography? Once you can get a big problem out in the open where everybody can talk about it, you're sort of halfway home to dealing with the difficulty. And I think the more we can talk about these problems and recognize those difficulties and sort of talk about the ways we have resolved our own issues, the better it is. Our high priest group in Manhattan is terrific on that. We're all old warriors in the church, been bishops, et cetera, and we talk about more difficulties than 99% of the Sunday school classes in the church, because we trust each other. We're quite willing to get them out in the open. And that's, I think, is really therapeutic and refreshing.
Yeah, it is good when you can talk about things in the open. I know in some respects, we tend to think that if the problem shows itself, so for instance, if the struggler comes forward and lets us know he's struggling, we'll reach out and try to help him. But in reality, most people who struggle with a faith crisis, at least for the long time in the beginning, seem to not say much at all. Is that the same experience you have in regards to talking to people? Does it seem like people tend to keep this inside and not really reveal it or talk about it almost until it's too late?
Well, yes, it's definitely that's the way. They sit in Sunday school class and really squirm. They feel very uncomfortable. And there's sort of two things. One, they don't want to out themselves as not really part of a group. You know, one of the reasons we bear testimony is to say, I'm one with you. We're all in this together. And if you bear an anti-testimony, you're in effect saying, I'm not part of the group. But the other side of it is that they're afraid they'll destroy other people. That if people knew what they knew, they would crumble. They couldn't bear up under it. So they're sort of forced into quiet. And eventually, that leads many, maybe most of them, to stop coming to church. They just can't bear it. They feel hypocritical, and they feel like they're disruptive, and so they just bow out entirely.
Right, so the problem never shows itself, and some of these people step away from their activity, and we're left to assume, probably assuming other reasons for their leaving, and in reality, we never gave them a safe place to talk about their doubts and to deal with them.
That's an important word these days, safe place. I think it begins with being a safe place to talking about your personal problems, you know, the struggles you're having with sickness or children or those sort of things. And certainly in relief studies in Sunday school, we should do that. It's hard in Sunday school class when it has another purpose to sort of air all of your problems. I really don't know how to get around that. We have to devise some way of getting people into an atmosphere when they're talk. That's where they can talk. That's one reason that Terrell and Fiona and I are giving these little seminars, is to let people get air their problems.
Right. Sometimes just being able to talk about it takes away a lot of the anxiety and the worry and concern out, just to know they're not alone, just to know other people are thinking about them and helping them to deal with this stuff head on. Well, I had one listener, when I mentioned that you were going to be on the program, I had one listener send me this question to ask, and they wanted to know, what do you think is the right way to handle when you're in a teaching responsibility in the church? So say you're given an assignment to teach a priesthood lesson one Sunday, and some things in the manual you don't quite agree with. What kind of approach do you take when you run into that from time to time?
Well, I always like to bring problems up. I mean, it sort of gives me a reputation as a troublemaker, and I don't really want to disrupt people. But I think it's a great thing for a group to have to deal with an issue, and you get more discussion and more strong thinking if you bring the question out in the open. If you do it in a iconoclastic way, trying to shock people or trouble them, it won't work. People don't want you to show off that you know more difficult questions than they could possibly answer. But if you say, look, we're brothers and sisters, here's a problem. How do we deal with this? What do we tell our children about this if this comes up, or our neighbors if they bring up the question? You can't do too much of that, but you can bring something like that up, I think, in lessons quite regularly, and the group will rally around you. You don't even have to have an answer for it. You let the group find an answer for it, and I think they'll have a great time in the process.
That's good advice. Often, and I didn't mean to, I guess, throw that question at you without any preparation. What I was thinking was, sometimes in the manual we'll have lessons on, for instance, Thomas Marsh and the milk strippings. And sometimes the manuals are very basic and simple, and they make stories in history out to be much simpler than what it is. And in reality, things can be a lot more difficult. And I think what you offer is a great point, which is don't duck away from the fact that there's something in the manual that you think is more complicated than what they're saying. Throw the question out there and get a discussion going. And like you say, there's ways to approach that that are helpful, and there's ways to approach that where you're demeaning from the class and to stay away from the latter.
Yeah, I would say so. The trouble with that nook-flipping stories, which makes me uncomfortable too, is that in order to turn it into a problem, you have to give a lot of historical background and say, this is not likely to be true, and here's what the real situation was. That's complicated. So I don't think that's a good example of something that a class can handle, because it's a matter of factual knowledge, which they don't have. You need something that has more of a moral or psychological dimension to it, which they can cope with better.
Excellent. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions in regards to Joseph Smith. We're talking to Richard Bushman today, author of Rough Stone Rolling, and it's a wonderful book. I've got it on my shelf, Brother Bushman, and I really enjoyed reading it. I was aware of all the issues prior to reading the book, but read it and just loved all the detail you gave about Joseph. I had another question from a listener who asked what your feelings are on Farm Brody's book, No Man Knows My History, as your book is kind of your book obviously tells the same story but leads with faith, and her book is more with the conclusion that Joseph was a fraud. But from the perspective of her being a writer and having come up with this biography of the prophet Joseph Smith many years before you tackled your project, any thoughts on how that work has influenced yours?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story about that. You know, both books were published by the same publisher, Alfred Knopf. And I told my editor, my book came out 60 years after hers, and I told my editor that this is at last the press's chance to get things straight on Joseph Smith. She thought it was kind of funny. But she also told me that the sales of No Man Knows My History jumped after my book came out. I guess it kind of became an issue and people wanted to hear both sides. But I'll say this about the book. It's a book that Mormons have hated and still dislike very much. But it actually is more favorable to Joseph Smith than we sometimes think. My historical colleagues, not Mormons, think it's a great book. And it is in this sense. Up to that time, the biographies of Joseph Smith had been caricatures. He was thought of as either demented or a complete charlatan. And they were sort of flat caricatures of a religious fanatic. They were unlike any real human being. And it's out of that background that Fawn Brody writes her book. And she turns Joseph Smith into a believable character. It's not, from our point of view, isn't admirable, but from the point of view of non-Mormons, he's kind of wonderful. He's raw. He may have been a fake in some ways, but he had immense bravado, and he had this amazing capacity for charming people and winning them over and building this great church. So I tend to speak rather positively of the book, historiographically speaking, even though I think Brody had a deaf ear. She was tone deaf to religious theological stuff. She was not religious herself, really, and she just couldn't appreciate it. She wrote, you know, in a period when religion was scoffed at generally among modern intellectuals. And so that is a great deficiency in the book, but it still, I think, is a marvelous achievement.
What, if Joseph Smith were here today, is there a question you'd like to ask him?
Well, my answer always to that is, did you enjoy being a prophet? And I say that because there are lots of indications he would have liked to have slowed things down. You know, he says shortly after the church is organized, well, now, brethren, we have the church, and all we have to do is go on living it. And then he gets a revelation he has to establish Zion and build up this priesthood organization. And after he organized the High Council, he says, now, brethren, I've given you all I have to give you. All we have to do is live the church. And then he gets temple ordinances and sealings. And so it went on right down to the end of his life. His own visions pursued him relentlessly. And in some sense, he's a victim of his own visions. He just could not stop setting forth things that tried the faith of the saints, that went beyond what they were really ready for, and required a lot of labor on his part to get them installed in the church. So I know he loved visions. He loved to receive the revelations, and he spoke of that. But on the other hand, he just didn't have a moment to rest. And I just wonder how he felt about his own life. And by the end, was he just worn out by all he was required to do?
Right. Do you ever get bored of talking or studying the prophet's life? I mean, after all this research you've done, you've written a book, you've spent as many hours as anybody delving into his life. Do you get kind of, at this point, bored of talking about him?
Well, not really. I suppose you can get bored with topics, but large people are subject to so many perspectives that it won't be too long before someone else is going to start a biography of Joseph Smith and write a different account of his life. All the big men in our history have had innumerable biographies written about them. Jefferson and Washington continue to attract biographers. So I keep finding in the Book of Mormon, for example, layer after layer of meaning. It just endlessly unfolds itself. So I'm quite happy to continue to be involved. Though I do have another life. I'm right now writing a book on 18th century farming. So I have a respite from Joseph Smith from time to time working on other subjects.
Gotcha. You talk about other people coming after you and writing biographies in the prophet. Your book is so exceptional. I feel like anybody would be intimidated trying to take on a project like that, knowing that you've set the bar as high as you have, and really appreciate your spending the countless hours and putting Joseph's life together in a way that shares the difficult history with us as Latter-day Saints, but does so in a way that we can walk away still having faith in him and in the restoration. So I want to say thank you for that. I got two more questions I want to ask you, and so the first one is this: is there a question that nobody has ever asked you that you want to be asked so that you can answer?
Well, I'm not sure I invite questions of that kind. There are questions I'd like to ask of other people, and we've sort of talked about one of them already, and that is, how can you be so sure that the church is not true? That is a question that that perplexes me. I just can't quite get my mind around it, partly because I tend to be more flexible in my own thinking. I can't imagine that other point of view. And what I am frequently asked is, how do I feel about Joseph Smith? And I do have great admiration for him, for his vigor and his resilience and his resolution. He didn't have many resources to work with, no standing in society, no wealth, no institutional structure, limited number of friends, and he had to work with very weak reeds. Those first people around him were so unsteady, came and went, and yet he had this vision of what he wanted to create, and he just would not yield. He just would not give up, no matter what failures he met. So I have a great responsibility, a great respect for that. And also his fecundity, his endless revelations flowed from him. I mean, if you see him as a human, he was his religious imagination just was bottomless. He came up with so much stuff, which continues to inspire people. We've got all these young intellectuals in the church who just love to work with Joseph Smith's writings, and especially the scriptures. And they just find him endlessly revealing and original and so forth. So I just somehow want to register how much respect I have for Joseph Smith.
I want to end the podcast on this question, which is, a large chunk of my listeners are people who are currently struggling right now with their faith, who are pondering and exploring and delving into these difficult issues and trying to make heads or tails of them. any counsel from you to them, to these individuals who are in the midst of their dark night of the soul?
Well, what I would say is be intellectually courageous and focused. It's once you encounter this stuff, it can be shocking, terrifying, and you just feel frozen and hardly know what to do. And then when you the evidence begins to mount up, you just say, I better get out of here. You just turn away from it. And from then on, there's a tendency to just read more and more things that confirm your decision. And there's more evidence that it's all phony. And it requires a lot of independence and a certain amount of courage to keep looking at all sides of the issue, to read the apologists as well as the critics, and to try and think it through for yourself. My number one piece of advice is don't falter. Go right into the heart of the problem. Try to figure out what is it precisely about this that is disruptive. What is it that troubles me most? And state that problem in the most severe form you can. And if you can state that problem as clearly as you can, and then try honestly to accumulate information that bears on all sides of the problem, that's the best way I think you'll arrive at a resolution. If you just read down a list of problems, read 20 things, and all of these are difficulties, you won't get anywhere. You'll just stay stuck where you are. But if you keep looking at things, take them one by one and say, what is it that's really worse about this? Then you'll be much better off. Let me just give one example to carry on here a little bit longer. That is the Book of Abraham. What is so horrible about the Book of Abraham? People say, well, it's the facts. The fact that the text of the Book of Abraham does not conform to what Egyptian scholars say is the contents of those scrolls. So you say, so obviously Joseph Smith was wrong. He was pretending. He faked the whole thing. But in my opinion, what we're really saying is that Joseph Smith didn't know what was on that text. The text itself is quite remarkable. The Book of Abraham, as it's in our scriptures, is an incredible document and is strangely like other Abrahamic texts from antiquity. So it holds up pretty well. What doesn't hold up is the fact that Joseph Smith thought he had the writings of Abraham, and he very well probably didn't have writings of Abraham. So the question is not the facts about was he right or wrong, but was he himself misled? And then it becomes a theological question. Would God allow a prophet to whom he wishes to give a revelation to misunderstand what the scrolls were that he had in his hand? And some people would say it's impossible and God would deceive his prophet. But others would say the aims of the Lord were to get this revelation out, and the fact that Joseph Smith didn't understand what he had is not particularly disruptive. Lots of prophets don't really understand. Probably lots of us don't understand lots of things about our lives. So that's why I say if you go right into the heart of the problem, I think in many cases it gets down to a theological or a moral issue rather than a factual one. And once you've stated that problem, would God let his prophet misunderstand something? Then I think you've got to the heart of the matter.
I think that's beautiful. When you, as you point out, especially when you talk about the Book of Abraham, what Joseph produced is not the problem; it's the method. And then the method obviously can be looked at in different ways. But when you go to what the actual production was of that method, that production holds up and appears to be an inspired work. Appears to match up with like you state. Other works that revolve around Abraham from antiquity. So I think you make a beautiful point there. I appreciate so much you being on. I'm having Terrell Givens on in a few weeks as well, and I split this up in two ways. I wanted you to speak to us in ways that we can be better supportive of the person struggling. I think you did a beautiful job of that. I just want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. I appreciate all the work you do. And I appreciate all the time you spend helping those who struggle in their faith.
Well, I'm very pleased to get to know you, Bill, and learn a little bit about what you're doing. I think it's voices like yours and podcasts like this that are eventually going to make it possible for people to deal confidently with all these problems that keep coming up.
Thank you, and have a great day, Brother Bushman. Thank you for listening to the Mormon Faircast. If there is an issue that you've been wondering about, you can often find the latest answers at the Fair Mormon Wiki, found at fairmormon.org. If you can't find your answer there, feel free to pose your question to the Fair Mormon Apologist by visiting the Fair Mormon contact page. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Tell your friends about us and help us increase the popularity of this podcast by subscribing in iTunes and by writing a review. Music for this episode was provided courtesy of Chris Rice. The opinions expressed in the podcast are not necessarily the views of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or of Fair Mormon.
Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious sonnet sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love. Here I raise my Ebenezer, here by thy great help I've come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God. He to rescue me from danger interposed his precious blood. Precious blood. That day when freed from sinning, I shall see thy lovely face. Clothed then in blood-washed linen, how I'll sing thy sovereign grace. Come, my Lord, no longer tarry, take my ransomed soul away. Send thine angels now to carry me to realms of endless day. Oh, to grace how great a debtor daily I am constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Here's my heart, oh, take and seal it. Seal it for